But it's good to be back, third Sunday of three. This is sort of a backdoor citizenship sermon. It's a Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1 is where we will begin. You'll see the part. I'll point out when we get to the part where I think it sort of connects there. I think Hans will be okay with it. You might know that I'm a runner. And I've been a runner, since I was in seminary. Before that, running was only punishment. The few sports I played in high school, you ran because you messed up. You ran because you didn't play hard enough or you didn't execute the way you were supposed to, and you ran. And so in my mind, running became identified with punishment. But then I was finished with school. I was no longer made to run for punishment, and I actually picked up running as something that I enjoyed doing. The ultimate, and I even like to race from time to time. You say race at my age. It's more like still running. But the marathon is the one that just captures my imagination. And it has such a great founding story. You know, Pheidippides in 490 BC is sent from Athens to Sparta to see if the Spartans will come and help as the Athenians battle the Persians. So he runs the 150 miles from Athens to Sparta in about 2 days. After a short rest, he runs the 150 miles back to Athens to tell them that the Spartans will not be coming to help in the battle, just in time to join in the battle, and the Athenians defeated the Persians. And then he was commanded to run the 26.2 miles from Marathon, the battlefield, to Athens to declare victory. And he did in just about 3 hours. He ran from the battlefield in Marathon to Athens, where he declared, Nene Kekamen, that would have been the word he used, we have triumphed. At which point, he died of exhaustion. Now, with a founding myth like that, what's not to love about the marathon? I've completed 2 marathons in my life, and I've drawn a few conclusions from that. The first conclusion is that the first 10, 11, 12 miles is a party. Now, I know for some of you think, no, there's no way 10 miles would be a party. But if you've trained for 26 and then you've tapered so that your engine's sort of, you know, ready to roar on race day, then those first miles, you feel like you could run forever. I mean, the adrenaline's pumping. There's lots of other participants. You know, you just feel it feels great. And there's people out there in costumes. And if you do the Memorial Marathon, it's very moving. The pre-run stuff is so moving and remembrance of the bombing. And you're just ready to run. And you feel like you could run forever. But then there's mile 12 and 13 and 14 and that's the point where the crowd starts to thin out. You get in other parts of the city and there may not be many people cheering you on along the side. And the participants start to thin out too. You know, you're all bunched together and you've got that, we're doing this together. And then you get on at about 13, 14, you get out around Lake Hefner and on down and there's not that many people running with you. And then about 16 or 17, you know, the weight of this distance emotionally and physically starts to take its toll on you. And about mile 16 or 17, you hit the wall. And you run by a first aid station, and you might see someone on a cot, pale and gaunt, with an IV in their arm, and you look over in there and you say, you lucky dog. But you keep pushing, and you get down to those last couple of miles, and now the crowds line the street again, and you feel that rush of adrenaline again, and you finish, and it feels like glory. We might think of our own spiritual walk, our Christian discipleship, personally. We might think of it like a race. We might think of the life of our church as like running a race. And not just any race, but a marathon. For the better part of 60 years, for over 60 years, since 1950 when this church was founded in the Nichols Hills area, this church has been running the race. And I'll have to say, I'm involved with a number of churches. I go to a number of churches. No church that I am a part of has had more of the party and part of the race than this church. Now, I'm not saying it's been a party every day. I'm not saying it's been easy to run every day. But when you look back over the history of this church since 1950, the race has gone well. You think about those early years with Dr. Naney, who was the pastor here from 1950 till about 1966. The church started with 113 charter members, and at the time when he retired, had over 1,000 members. Now, that sounds like the part of the race where you feel like you can run forever. And then a young man named Charlie Graves was called as the pastor. 31 years, Charlie Graves pastored this church. And the church continued to grow to the point that in 1979, the vote was made to move to this location because the location in Nichols Hills would not be large enough. That's how good things were going. The name of the church was changed, I think, 1988, Quail Springs Baptist Church, to reflect where the church actually sits. I'm privileged to get to know Charlie. I got to know him when at my early years at OBU and when I was coming here. That was a great privilege. And then Charlie, in 1998, he retired. Mac Roark became the interim. He actually invited me to come over and preach when he was not able to. That was my first exposure to this church early in my time at OBU. Brian Waite pastored for a couple of years. And then in 2003, I served as interim before, but in 2002. In 2003, you called Hans Dilbeck as your pastor. And now this last decade, over a decade actually, has definitely felt like a party. Feel like you can run forever. As a church, I mean, it's been a pretty good decade. In every measurable way, this church is just off the charts in this period. And it's not only Hans. I mean, I could look at Ray and Roy, and everywhere you look, there's a staff member, or there's somebody who's come on in the last decade or who may have been here before that has helped this church have such a great history. Now, I'm not saying it's going to always be like this, but the life of this church has felt a great deal like those first 12 miles when you feel like you can run forever. But the day's going to come. I hope maybe we're not here to see it. Maybe it'll be so far in the future. But the day's going to come. And when it does, these days might encourage us to continue to run well in those days when you feel like you've hit the wall. It's true of churches. It's true of individual believers. In Hebrews chapter 12, now we're going to read 11, but in chapter 12, The author of Hebrews, and I don't know who wrote it. Who wrote it, only God knows. That doesn't claim who the author is. But whoever wrote Hebrews uses the image of a race to picture the Christian life. That only makes sense when you look at chapter 11, which leads up to chapter 12. You can't understand the race metaphor he uses in chapter 12, verses 1 through 3, unless you look at the list of those who ran well in chapter 11. They serve as models for us to imitate. And the ultimate model is presented in chapter 12, verse 2 and 3, Jesus, the trailblazer, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith. These are the models. These are the people who ran before us, who show us what it means to run the race well. The author of Hebrews warns against drifting away from the word of Christ. The author of Hebrews warns against not having faith like the Israelites in the wilderness. There are warning passages in Hebrews. But in this section, chapters 11 and the early part of chapter 12, the author encourages us to continue on with our Christian lives, even when it gets hard, even when we hit the wall. And he does it positively by saying, look at the example of those who've gone before us. And keep your eyes fixed on the right things. This will help us as we run the race. Now, in this text, the life that we live as Christians is pictured like running a race. He gives us examples of those who've gone before. It's the same motivation that a runner might find by thinking about names like Roger Bannister or Eric Liddell or Steve Prefontaine or any great runner from history, Joan Benoit Samuelson. These great runners, Frank Shorter, these are the names that might inspire you to keep going as a runner, even when it gets hard. Well, this author calls upon us to remember the names Abel, Enoch, Noah, Abraham, David, Samson, and a host of others that he does not have time to name. Hebrews chapter 11 is a beautiful work of art. 28 times in this chapter it says, by faith, by faith, by faith. He opens with 18 up-close profiles of Christians or of believers in God who ran the race well, who kept their faith despite difficult circumstances. And then he turns the corner to the point where I could go on and on, but I need to finish up, so let me just summarize. Others who faced all types of trial and suffering and hardship, but continued to run the race well. That's what chapter 11 presents us. Let's open up. Let's begin there at Hebrews 11, 1. Now, faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not yet see. This is what the ancients were commended for. By faith, we understand that the universe was formed at God's command so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. By faith, Abel brought God a better offering than Cain did. By faith, he was commended as righteous when God spoke well of his offerings. And by faith, Abel still speaks, even though he is dead. By faith, Enoch was taken from this life so that he did not experience death. He could not be found because God had taken him. For before he was taken, he was commended as one who pleased God. And without faith, it is impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. By faith, Noah, verse 7, when warned about the things not yet seen, in holy fear built an ark to save his family. By his faith, he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness that is in keeping with faith. And these first three names are the names of individuals, people of God, who maintained their faith and demonstrated it by their actions. Abel, who presented the offering to God that was pleasing to God. Enoch, who walked with God such that he was just taken and did not have to face death. And then, of course, Noah, who, in the face of all odds, looking ridiculous, looking strange, builds an ark before there's even a drop of water falling from the sky. These are people whose faith was demonstrated by their actions. They have gone before us. They are examples to us. This is how we should live our lives. We should demonstrate our faith by our actions. As he goes on in the next verse, verse 8, I think it turns just a bit away from those. It's not only that they demonstrated faith by their actions, but now it's Abraham and his family who demonstrated their faith by being willing to go on a journey, to become immigrants, refugees, strangers, pilgrims, people on a journey. And they do it by faith. Verse 8, by faith, Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. By faith, he made his home in the promised land like an immigrant. And there's our word from last week. In a foreign country, he lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. And by faith, even Sarah, who was past childbearing age, was enabled to bear children because she considered him faithful who had made the promise. And so, from this one man, and he as good as dead, came descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as countless as the sand of the seashore. All these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance, admitting that they were foreigners and refugees on earth. People who say such things show that they are looking for a country of their own. If they had been thinking of the country they'd left, they would have returned. Instead, they were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. And here is that image of a person, a family, Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Jacob, a family who by faith was willing to journey, was willing to set out not knowing the conclusion of the journey. The conclusion was uncertain, but to go by faith and become wanderers looking for a city whose maker was God, whose citizenship was in heaven. These are the examples that we are to follow. People who are willing to go on a journey. People who are willing to follow God wherever he calls them. Sometimes it's risky. Sometimes it's not easy. Sometimes it's dangerous. And some of you have children right now who have put themselves in a place that would be considered dangerous for most of us. And why have they done it? Because they believe that God has called them there. That's the kind of faith that is demonstrated by Abraham and his family. And then in 17, the list turns again. This is not just a random list of people who were faithful. Now the list turns to those who were tested by God through suffering, through hardship, through torture, and even through death. And despite that, remained faithful. Verse 17, by faith Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. He who had embraced the promises was about to sacrifice his one and only son, even though God had said to him, it is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned. Abraham reasoned that God could even raise the dead, and so, in a manner of speaking, he did receive Isaac back from the dead. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau in regard to their future. By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of Joseph's sons and worshipped him, and worshipped as he learned of the leaned at the top of his staff. By faith, Joseph, when his end was near, spoke about the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt and gave instructions concerning the burial of his bones. By faith, Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born because they saw he was no ordinary child and they were not afraid of the king's edict. By faith, Moses, when he'd grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as a greater value than the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking ahead to his reward. By faith, he left Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. He persevered because he saw him who is invisible. By faith, he kept the Passover and the application of the blood so that the destroyer of the firstborn would not touch the firstborn of Israel. By faith, the people passed through the Red Sea as on dry land, but when the Egyptians tried to do so, they were drowned. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell after the army had marched around them for 7 days. By faith, the prostitute Rahab, because she welcomed the spies, was not killed with those who were disobedient. They were persecuted. They faced all manner of suffering, and yet they persevered. They continued to run the race by faith. And at this point, the author of Hebrews said, I could go on forever. I only have so much scroll here. And so it takes a turn. He says, and what more shall I say? And now the list really picks up. I don't have time to tell you about Gideon, who defeated the Midianites, the Israelite who helped the Israelites defeat the Midianites, or Barak, who along with Deborah helped defeat Sisera and the Canaanites, or Samson, or Jephthah, who helped defeat the Ammonites, about David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, administrated justice, and gained what was promised, who shut the mouths of lions, you might think of Daniel, who quenched the fury of the flames, Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, and escaped the edge of the sword, whose weakness was turned to strength, and who became powerful in battle and routed foreign armies. Women received back their dead, raised to life again. There were others who were tortured, refusing to be released so that they might gain an even better resurrection. Some faced jeers and flogging and even chains and imprisonment. They were put to death by stoning. They were sawed in two. They were killed by the sword. They went about in sheepskin and goatskins, destitute, persecuted, and mistreated. The world was not worthy of them. They wandered in deserts and mountains and in caves and holes in the ground. These are our spiritual forefathers. They ran a very difficult race. Suffering, torture, even death. And yet they ran well, and they are our example of how to run this race. These were all commended, verse 39, these were all commended for their faith, yet none of them received what had been promised. God had planned something better for us, so that only together with us, they would be made perfect. At least two things jump out at me reading Hebrews chapter 11. First of all, God is probably calling us to do something that requires faith. God is probably asking you and me to do something today that might require a journey, that might be difficult, that might end up costing us persecution or suffering. Something that would require that we have faith to take up some decision, some journey, some action, and we don't know the conclusion, and we can't ensure our safety. But we take the risk because we have faith. We believe in invisible things, in a future that is yet invisible, but we trust God. Hearing this list, how could we think, well, God required something that requires faith of them, but he probably wouldn't do it of me. The other thing that jumps out at me as I read Hebrews 11 is the inspiration that we can draw from those who have responded to God's call, who have gone before us. These names are familiar to most of you, and we should trust God as they did. But it's not only those names. I think there are names that might be more familiar to you. Names like Charlie Graves, or Guy Del Porter, or Charles Jones, or Hazel Kendrick, or John McDonald, or Nita Rainey. These are names that resonate with me from my time at this church. These are the ones who call us to be faithful, to run the race well, to follow their example. The writer concludes with this odd statement in verse 39 that these were all commended for their faith, yet none of them received what was promised. God had planned something better for us so that only together with us they would be made perfect. Somehow, those who've gone before us receiving everything that God has for them is tied somehow to the way I run the race. We are bound together. This is the way God has designed it. We usually stop at verse 38 in Hebrews 11 and fail to note that somehow they're receiving everything God has for them is somehow tied to the way I run my race. Look at verse chapter 12, verse 1. Therefore, in light of this great list of heroes of the faith who lived their lives by faith, and by virtue of the fact that somehow they're receiving everything God had promised is somehow tied together with us. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer, the trailblazer, and perfecter of faith. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinners, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. We are running a race. We have this great list of those who ran before us, and now the race is ours. How does he describe the race? What is his description here of the race? What type of race is it that we're running? Look again at 12:1. Since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. The word that the author of Hebrews uses for the race is a Greek word, agon. Does that sound similar to an English word? Agony. We get our word agony from the word he uses here for race. The race that he is describing, living the Christian life, the life of discipleship, is not a sprint. It is not a 1 mile fun run. Now, I'm not saying every day is going to be like a marathon. Every day is not going to be like you hit the wall. Just like every day for a church. Every year in the life of a church is not like hitting the wall and just having to gut it out. No, not every day, but many days. We're not in this in the short haul. It's not a sprint. It's a marathon. It's a race that at times will involve agonizing struggle. You'll hit the wall sometimes, and you'll know what I'm talking about. We much prefer sort of comforted happiness. This is what we seek. We, as human beings, will do whatever is necessary to make ourselves happy. We make decisions in life based on what will make me happy. We seek happiness, and we often do terrible things. We often do destructive things in the name of my personal happiness. That's not the kind of race we're running here. It's not a race that will involve personal happiness every step of the way. Joy, yes. Happiness, maybe. Many days. But sometimes it'll just feel like a struggle. If we're finding it too comfortable, perhaps something is wrong. If we're finding it too comfortable, maybe we should ask ourselves, am I really running the race? I have a good friend who works at OU. His name's Kenny Mossman. We were talking about, he was going through the process of training to be a foster parent. I remembered what he said to me about determining to be a foster parent and to go through that process. He said, I realized that in all my life, I can count on one hand the number of times I put myself out in order to be obedient to God. He asked himself, am I running the race? And he determined that he needed to do more. How should we run this race that often will involve agonizing struggle? We get that also in chapter 12, verse 1. He says, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race set before us. Let us lay aside those things that hinder us. Now, he doesn't call them sinful things. He's got a line for that next, and the sin that so easily entangles us. But there are things that might hinder you from running the race well that in and of themselves are not sinful. You may get up every morning looking for your newspaper, or get up and turn on the news, to watch the morning news, to see the weather and see what's going on in the world. Nothing wrong with that. That's not sinful to do that. But if those things keep you from reflection on God's Word, if you never get around to reading Scripture because you're always reading the newspaper and checking the morning weather, then we've got a problem. Running and golf. I'll use running and golf as examples of things. I don't think there's anything sinful about running or golf. Now, golf can be so frustrating it might lead to something sinful, but in and of itself, no. But if your commitment to your running, your commitment to play golf so many days a week, starts to do damage to your family or to your commitment to Christ and to the church, now it becomes something that hinders us. and will not allow us to breathe easily and to run well. The sin that so easily entangles us. There are so many addictions that can get hold of us that are sinful that keep us from running the race well. I pass at least three casinos on my way to preach here this morning. I think about the devastating destruction of that kind of addiction. And there's all sorts of addictions, the internet pornography and alcohol and painkillers and dieting. And there's so many sinful addictions that can entangle us and we won't be able to run this race well. We spend so much time worried about the outside. If we got the technical gear and we've got our body fat down, we think we're ready to run the race. We are interested in scales and measuring tapes and mirrors and selfies. If we look good on the outside, we think we're probably okay for the race. What the author of Hebrews is calling us to do is look past the outside and look on the inside. Maybe you look good on the outside, but inside you're flabby and shabby and not prepared to run this race because of the sin that is so easily entangling. And then what motivates us to run? He starts out by saying, therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, these great people of faith that are mentioned here in chapter 11, these others that I mentioned, and so many more that I can't name, that are your spiritual heroes, they come together as a great cloud, a great throng, a great mass of those who are watching us run. And they're cheering us on. And this is not the guy who's at the marathon to cheer with a donut in each hand. This isn't the guy in your neighborhood who watches you run by in the evening as you're getting in your miles and it's hot. And he's got a hot dog in one hand and a drink in the other that you wouldn't drink because you're in training. These are people who ran the race. And they ran it well. And they ran it with distinction. And they're there to cheer us on. And they're there to be seen by us, to encourage us. Because they are united with us in this race. It's a marathon, but it's also one where we pass the baton. It was passed to us, and now we pass it forward. Someday we will. And we become part of something much greater than ourselves. We are inspired by those who've gone before us. Their final heritage is tied up in how we run the race. And someday, when this life is over for us, we will pass the baton to others who will carry it forward until Jesus comes back. And it makes our lives of eternal value. My life is worth so much more than the 50 or 60 or 70 or 80 or 90 years that I'm able to live here. I join my story to those who've gone before. I join my story to those who will go after me. And this encourages me to run this leg of my race and to run it well. But it's not just this cloud of witnesses. He says in verse 2, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer, the trailblazer, and perfecter of faith. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Here's the ultimate example. Here's the one who blazed the trail. Here's the one who's removed the obstacles. So we might have a few hurdles, but the path has been cleared. We're to fix our eyes on him, who for the joy set before him. What joy? Perfection? Relationship with his Father? He already had those things. What was the joy set before him that motivated Jesus to go to the cross, to suffer the scorn and the shame? What did he not yet have that he had to finish that course in order to attain? You and me. It was the reality that in order for us to be his, in order that we might experience forgiveness, he had to finish the course. We were the joy set before him. And now we're motivated to run our part of the race by fixing our eyes on the one who fixed his eyes on us. It's amazing how fixing your eyes on the goal can help you ignore the pain and the struggle and the challenge and to keep running even when you've hit the wall. When you run this marathon in Oklahoma City, you finally get out to Lake Hefner. Wind's probably whipping out there, but, you know, it's okay because at some point, you turn back towards the city and you can see the tower and you can't see the finish line. But if you fix your eyes on that tower, it'll motivate you to keep running. We're running our race. We look at this cloud of witnesses that have gone on before us. We fix our eyes on Jesus and we keep running and we run well. We are his joy and he will be with us to the end. Let us pray. Our Father, I pray you would speak to our hearts about those things that may hinder, that may entangle us, that might keep us from running well. Father, may we be motivated by those who've gone before us to lay these things aside. May we be motivated by Jesus and fixing our eyes on Him to lay these things aside and to keep running. I pray if there's someone here today who's never started this race, there might be moments of struggle, but it's the only race that leads to life. May someone come to you today in the name of Christ. Amen.